Paul and Bella Javasi have been on the mission field doing the work that they've been faithful to do for 38 years. Isn't that something? And I'm sure that they would be quick to say that that's only because of God's faithfulness in their lives. But he has faithfully used them, and they have been faithfully available to be used. And so what a blessing that's been for the people of Indonesia and for the people of our church to be able to be privileged to help in their support over these many years as well. So without further ado, I ask Paul to come up and maybe Bella as well. I'm not sure, but the time is yours. Thank you very much for coming.
Morning. It's always good to be here. First time I ever came here, I think it was 1976. I came with Dunn Gordy. I was actually part of a singing group. We traveled, three guys. We traveled all day from Baker, Oregon. I can't remember how many hours it is, but like 8 hours. And we got here, and I guess the pastorate was sort of over where the school offices are now. And Pastor Marzoff said, "Oh, great, new tribers, let's go witnessing." So we let Dunn handle that one. We were pretty beat. But yeah, it's been a while, and we always enjoy coming here and appreciate you guys so much. We've been there. We've been married for 43 years, and we've been in the field for 38 years. And people say, "Oh, wow! How do you do that?" So, well, you just wake up every day and keep doing it. It's not really that hard, especially the marriage thing. How do you stay married? Well, how do you stay married? You stay alive. That's the key. And you don't divorce. It's pretty simple. And I'm thrilled to be married to my wife, actually. I know you're supposed to say that, but it's really true. She's very much a partner in what we do. She's also hurt. I don't know if you see her. She's her hands all bandaged up. We've been in urgent care 3 times this week. She burned it pretty badly. And so And she's her big concern is that the bandage is ugly. All right. What we're doing over there, we're working in Indonesia. I know some people sometimes, just this morning, somebody mentioned something about Papua New Guinea. I get that at my home church all the time because most of the missionaries seem to be in Papua New Guinea. But we're in Indonesia, which is just to the west of that, much larger country. We work on the island of Borneo. And we work with a tribe of people called the Sekadau people. We work in a village called Probut. You're not going to be given a quiz on this. That wasn't a thought I had before I came here. But I say that because people, well, do you work with the Sekadau people or the Probut people? Well, we work with the Sekadau people. The village we live in is called Probut. We've done, initially, I thought that I would be doing pretty much what I did in Gerai, and that would be discipleship, curriculum development, of course, evangelism, outreach. But now it's down to just my wife and I, so we're also doing translation. And I thought I'd start off just a little bit talking about translation, the way we do it, the process that we go through. Translating people, how do you do that? Well, first of all, we have good helps. We have things from SIL and things from United Bible Society, and translating doesn't take as long as it used to, and it's not because translators are smarter. Everybody, wow, you can do this in 10 years. Well, and it used to take 30. Yeah, it's not that we're 3 times as smart, but we have a lot of helps that we didn't used to have. Plus, we have computers that really speed things along. My job is I do the exegesis, which just means that actually it's fun. I enjoy that part of it a lot. I go in and I'm looking at helps. I'm looking at, I have a number of different translations I look at. I have one that's more, how would you say, more literal, I guess you would say. And then I have some others that you look at to see, well, what else could that mean? What else could that? Most of the time it's pretty straightforward. Jesus got into a boat and sailed across to Nazareth. Well, yeah, that's pretty simple. And that doesn't take, I don't have to study a long time to figure out what that means. But there's other places that it's a little bit more difficult. So I do the exegesis, which means I sit down and I make a draft into the Sakata language. The next thing I do is I've got, I think, four pictures that don't necessarily... actually, the man in the red shirt is the guy that I work with for vocabulary check. It's not just vocabulary. I'll read through it with them. It's vocabulary. It's am I saying this right? If there's maybe an expression that I'm looking for, they have idioms, they have expressions, they have ways of saying things, and I don't always remember all those. So this guy's not older chronologically, but he's kind of the older generation. He knows the old language well. So he's a good man to work with for that. Then I do a recording check. So far it's all me, but we're going to get to Bell in a second. I do a recording check where I will read the a passage, and I will have him, it's a man I work with, he will repeat it back to me, because the theory is that people will not repeat something back in bad language. You know, if somebody who comes over here and says something in broken English and asks you to repeat it, generally speaking, you're going to clean that up, you know, unless you want to make fun of them. Otherwise, you know. And so that's the theory. It doesn't work as well as I would hope it would. They say, oh, no, that sounds just right. And I know that it doesn't. but it does eventually get cleaned up. So then I hand it to Bella at that point, and she does three comprehension checks with three different people. She has to sit and... make questions. She'll read through a passage. For instance, the thing I just mentioned, Jesus, and this is not a verse, I'm just saying this. Jesus got into a boat and sailed across to Nazareth. She would ask questions like, who got in the boat? And where do they sail to? And if they can't give that back, then you know something's wrong. Well, gee, this isn't what it's supposed to be saying this, and it doesn't. That's a pretty simple one. I don't know that we've ever had a problem with that kind of a statement. But other things, you get a little more complicated, and you start asking, well, who's doing this? And if they can't figure out who's doing it, then I have to fix it. And, you know, Bella will come back to me then after, sometimes after one comprehension check, sometimes after two or all three of them, she'll say, they're not getting it. And if they're not getting it, then I have to fix it so they can get it. And then we'll check it again. At that point, then we do a what's called a back to English, and that's my job again. It's one of the things I'm doing on home assignment now, is I'm working on back to English for John, and then I'll move on to 1 Corinthians. We've gotten the translation to the point that I just mentioned. Now I have to retranslate it back into English, not word for word, because that would be incomprehensible, but as close as I can, so that the translation checker can. He doesn't speak Sakata, so he looks at it in English. He's looking to see, is everything supposed to be there? Are you consistent in the words that you're using? This is the same word in Greek. Why do you use four different words for this? That kind of thing. And then he writes notes and questions, which are very exhaustive and exhausting, sends it back to me. That's probably 20, 30 pages of notes and questions. I am actually amazed that these checkers do this. And then I guess that was the last one. This is a checker, by the way, the guy in the blue shirt's one of the checkers. And so I go through the notes and questions. Sometimes he'll challenge me on an exegetical choice I've made. In other words, why did you say it this way? And so as long as I can explain to him why I did that and have some support for that, then he's okay with it. But if I can't, I just go, I don't know. You know, and then usually if that's where I am, I'll change it. So send it back to him, and then he comes for a check. The checking procedure is the checker. Okay, I'm taking the picture here, okay? So the checker, the man in the blue shirt, he will say to me, read this passage. And I will, usually it's like a paragraph. So I will read that in Sakata. And then these two people will, not simultaneously, of course, but they will give it back as much as I can remember in Sakata. Bella's translating it then for the checker. The checker's listening and making notes for, well, what are they saying? What are they not saying? What are they leaving out? What are they missing? And then he'll have follow-up questions. So that at that point, I have the easiest job, actually. I just read it, and then I let them work. And then he'll say to Bella, would you ask them, you know, for instance, they didn't say it was Jesus that went across to get to Nazareth. Ask them who went across. So then who went across? And if they, you go, I don't know, then there's probably something wrong. Of course, sometimes you do get, I'm trying to have a synonym for not too bright. Some of the checkers are more talented than others. And for instance, the guy in the pink shirt, we had to fire him and his wife. I mean, we literally had to fire. They were going to work for 3 days, and they were excited, and they're all believers. And they were so bad that we weren't making any progress. And the checker says, we can't keep doing this. And it's extremely frustrating when that happens, to try and spend, you know, 4 hours with somebody in the morning and you don't get anything done. And it's not because the translation's not communicating. It's because they won't talk. So we actually had to fire them. So and it's exhausting for them as well. So that's, after that's done, occasionally there'll be things that obviously are not communicating, and I will, usually if I'm listening, I can figure out why. And then, because, like I said, my job is a little easier during the check, I will sit there and make the change right on the spot. We'll check it right then. And that's really, that's nice to do it that way. The other alternative is, if I can't do that, is that I have to check it after the checker's gone. And then at that point, then it's ready to print. So we have, I don't know, something like 30-some percent that could be printed. We have another 20-something percent that's ready for the checkers at this point. So we have 55% done. Now, a key to exegesis, which is my first job, is understanding what's being said. And that might sound real simple, but I remember years ago, we had a speaker named Rudy Johnson. He came to our training center, and he was talking about a friend of his, and he saw his friend's Bible, and in the margins, occasionally, he'd have a bone. And so Rudy, who was from the South, he said, why you got all those bones in your Bible? And he said, the bones represent things I don't understand. So I eat the meat all the way up to the bone, and then I skip over and I eat the meat. Well, that works great. It doesn't work great, but it might work if you're reading the Bible, but it's not going to work if you're translating. If you don't know what it means, guess what? You translate something and it's not going to make any sense to them. What's the point of doing that, honestly? If I don't know what a verse means, and so I know all the words that I can translate that word for word, and it'll be in there. It's a bone, and it's forever going to be a bone. They're never going to get anything out of that. So, and I believe that I'm going to say for the most part, but I would almost want to say all of it. I believe that Bible was written to be understood. I know people like to quote that verse that Peter said about Paul, that Paul writes some things that are hard to understand and people distort them. Okay, he wasn't saying the language Paul was using was so difficult they didn't know what he was saying. What he was saying is that Paul was talking about grace and people were not understanding, and that was what was being distorted, was Paul's teachings on grace. And you've read them in English. You can understand the words. It's the concepts that they were having trouble with, not the words. So, but I've heard people quote that verse to say, see, the Bible's not supposed to be understood. Even back then, they didn't understand it. Well, yeah, they did. So anyway, just so you know, word-for-word translations, and I've gotten this before. We've gone to places where they're King James only, and they're very strong on that, and they'll say the only translation that's worth anything is a word-for-word translation from the King James. Well, it's not King James, not King James, but any word-for-word translation from one language to the other is not going to communicate. And most of us as Americans only speak English. And so and when you only speak one language, it's really hard to understand why a word-for-word wouldn't work. Well, people don't say things in the same way. They don't put their sentences together in the same way. They don't even necessarily put their paragraphs together in the same way. And so a word-for-word translation is probably going to be incomprehensible. This is Mark. This is actually the Greek. This is not Greek. You probably, unless you think maybe that you've magically read Greek, but this is a word-for-word translation. And I just randomly picked a verse. So I didn't go through and find the hardest verse I could. I wouldn't know how to do that, honestly. But and you'll recognize the verse. So, I mean, especially because you probably read the Bible a lot, but whoever one of such children receives the name of me receives, and whoever me receives, not me receives, but the one having sent me. So if you were translated that in English, you could probably figure it out, but it's not good English. Mm-hmm. And none of your Bibles say this. But this is what it says in Greek. And this is a bad illustration, because like I say, I just grabbed a verse. Bad illustration of why word-for-word translations don't work. So you have to think, well, what is the person, if there's a person talking or if he's writing, what is he trying to say here? And that's what I want to communicate, is what he's trying to say. If, for instance, and they don't have this in the Bible either, but they do use idioms in the Bible. And some of them really throw us, actually. But if somebody said, man, I went outside, it was raining cats and dogs, and I translated that literally, well, what do I know that raining cats and dogs means? It's raining really hard. So is that a bad translation if I translate that into another language and say it was raining really hard? Well, no, because that's what raining cats and dogs means. And so anyway, that translation. I love the exegetical part of it. But this is a verse that I spent, two verses, whatever, that I spent a long time on. Actually, the entire passage I spent a long time on. This is Mark 9. And I didn't realize it. Kind of blithely went into it, and I'm going into it and going, oh my goodness. And so I wrote back to somebody, and they said, oh yeah, Mark 9, that's one of the hardest passages in the Bible. Oh no, okay, good. Because I was struggling. For everyone will be salted with fire, and there's some idioms in here, and they're not. This idiom is not used the same way every time. At least the salt is not used the same way. And for everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if the salt becomes unsalty, with what will you make it salty again, or what will you season it? What will you use to season it again? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. He uses salt three times there, but he's saying three different things. And I really struggled with this one because I wasn't sure what it meant. And I remember clearly sitting in a Bible study with a bunch of men, some of whom pretty mature, had studied the Bible for a long time. And I remember when we got this one, everybody's scrambling to look at their notes, you know. And it's like, well, salt's a preservative. Yeah, salt's a preservative, you know, all these things. But the truth is, when Jesus said things generally, when he talked in parables, the disciples would say to him afterward, what did that mean? Okay, when he finished this, nobody said, what did that mean? So what does that tell me? They understood what he meant. Well, why don't we understand it? Well, I think because these are idioms, and we don't necessarily know what the idioms are. And he's very clever. It's very, that's the thing I've been struck with translating too, is that it doesn't always come across in English how clever some of the Bible writers were. Excellent writers, really clever. And here Jesus is using salt in three different ways. And it was just a clever thing he did. It was, you know, he spoke well. So I had to go through and I had to figure out, well, what does this mean? For everyone will be salted with fire actually belongs, if you read the previous verses, it would make more sense because he's talking about unbelievers going to hell, but he says, but everyone's going to be salted with fire. In other words, all of us are going to go through hard times. This is not, you know, it's just because you're not going to go to hell doesn't mean, but anyway, and then salt is good, but if the salt becomes unsalty, with what will you make it salty again? I'm not going to explain this verse, by the way. Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another, apparently is an idiom. There's a verse in Galatians which I remembered last night, but I didn't write it down. But it actually really helps clarify this verse. And salt has to do, apparently, based on what I read in Galatians, has to do with fellowship, the salt of fellowship. And if you look at the passage, if you look at the beginning of when Jesus is talking, and it's hard to do in English because we have passage markers and headings. You know, Jesus talks about this. Jesus talks about that. You know, Jesus talks about this. But he's just talking. He doesn't say, now I'm going to talk about this. He's just talking to them. And if you read, well, where is the start? It starts up a little about halfway up the chapter when they're arguing with one another. They're fighting about who's going to be the greatest. And this is him at the end saying, you guys need to get along, basically. You need to get along with one another. And that's... So I did explain that part of it, but he's probably sitting down. That's not what it means. That's fine. Here's another verse I have not translated yet. Okay. Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself. And we add our testimony, and you know that our testimony is true. What does that mean? I don't understand most of it, but he's received a good testimony from everyone. Everyone speaks highly of this guy. Okay. And from the truth itself. Huh? Who's the truth itself? What's the truth itself? How is it speaking about Demetrius? You know, and I'm sure we have different ideas, but I'm going, well, I think it means this, and I think it means that. And I'm good, you know, you probably should be a translator. But I remember the first time I read this, I noticed it, because now when I read things, I not only read it for myself, but I also get to things and go, wow, I don't know how in the world I'm going to translate that when I get to it. So I'm noticing things I don't understand is what it comes down to. I'm finding the bones in my Bible. So this is not one I haven't translated, so I don't have an answer for you as to how I'm obviously going to be looking at a lot of commentaries and seeing what other people said, looking at other translations and seeing what they do with this. And frankly, none of them really do anything with this. And that's what I'm finding too, is that when you get in something really difficult, the easiest thing to do is to translate it word for word so that it doesn't carry any meaning. Since it doesn't mean anything, I don't know what it means, I'll do it word for word and that's safe. You know, nobody's ever going to say, boy, you did that wrong. I say, no, it's word for word, see? But the deal is that it doesn't make any sense. And that's what they've done in English and from the truth itself. Yeah, is he talking about Jesus? And if it's talking about Jesus, is how did Demetrius get a good testimony from Jesus? I'm sorry. Anyway, I don't understand that verse. So that's translation. I guess it's not. I got one more verse. Okay, this is just kind of things that you might want to think about. And we haven't translated Luke yet either. When this is Jesus, of course, when he approached Jerusalem, he saw the city and he wept over it. He wept over it? Well, we understand what that means in English. That's easily understood in English. But when we're translating it, I can't say he wept over it. You know, he's like hovering in a balloon. It may not make sense to the people you're translating to. So you're going to have to say he wept because of it. Saying, if you had known in this day, even you. Why even you? If you had known this day, even you. Do you say that? I don't say that. So, and I haven't translated this yet. I suspect it's an emphasis thing. That's what I suspect. Usually when there's redundancy in the Bible, truly, truly, I say to you, it's an emphasis thing. We don't do that in English so much. Well, we do sometimes, you know. Some people do it way, way too much. But the language you're in may not do that. The things which made for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you. Do we say this? The days will come upon you. The days will come upon you. Where? Can I dodge? You know, these days are going to come. You know, it's an idiom, obviously, and we've translated it literally. And we know what it means, especially those of us who have been Christians for a long time. We speak Bible. We just do. We just know how we know the idioms and we know the way they speak. So it doesn't bother us. In fact, we don't even notice it because we've heard it so often. The days will come upon, when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you. Okay, is this something that we would know about? Do our tribal people, if I say they're going to throw up a barricade, a bulwark, if I even say they're going to throw up a earthen wall against your city, do they have any idea what that means? So you have two choices when you get to that. And again, we have not translated this yet. You can either put a footnote down there that says, that explains why they're doing this. Do you know why they're doing it? I'm assuming you do. They had a wall around Jerusalem. They would build an earthwork thing, and that way the soldiers could just kind of go up and over. Anyway, but the Jews knew exactly what it was because they were very familiar with how people made war back in those days, they understood this. But we may have to say something like, your enemies will build dirt ramps around the walls of your city so the soldiers can go over the walls and defeat you. Or if you don't want to put that there, then you put it in a footnote at the bottom. And surround you and hem you in on every side. Hemming in, it's a good descriptive phrase if your culture sews. When we first went into Garai, a lot of them were wearing bark clothing and they did not sew. So if your culture doesn't sew and you say that you were hemmed in, I don't think they'd be able, I don't think you could do it. I don't think you could say that. So you'd have to find another idiom. Okay, and they will level you to the ground and your children within you. Now that's an interesting, because as I looked at other translations, some of them said they will dash you to the ground and they will dash your children to the ground, which is what they literally did. They took the babies and they smashed them against rocks and killed them. Horrible, I know, and that's probably why we translate it this way, because that is horrible. And we didn't want that in our Bible, but that's what they did. And it's very possible that's what he's saying. They're going to kill you, and they're going to kill your children, basically. But yeah, they will level you to the ground, and your children within you. Doesn't really, even in English. Okay. And they will not leave one stone upon another because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. Okay? The time of your visitation? What's he talking about? Well, he's talking about the time that God came, Emmanuel, came and walked among them. The time the Messiah showed up, they didn't recognize it. That's what he's talking about. But if I just say the time of visitation, and I could come up with a word for visitation, the time when somebody visited you. Is that what he's saying? You didn't recognize when a visitor came. Well, yeah, no, he's talking specifically about the time when Christ came. So these are some of the issues we have with translation. I wanted to throw this in. I'm just going to read this. This is a translation. It's a very literal translation from a Chinese hotel brochure. I've taken out some of the more distasteful things. So this is from a brochure. This is from an actual brochure in a Chinese hotel. It says, getting there. A representative will make you wait at the airport. The bus to the hotel runs along the lake shore. Soon you will feel pleasure in passing water. You will know that you are getting near the hotel because you will go round the bend. And the hotel, it says, this is a family hotel, so children are very welcome. We, of course, are always pleased to accept adultery. Highly skilled nurses are available in the evenings to put down your children. Guests are invited to conjugate in the bar and expose themselves to others. But please note that ladies are not allowed to have babies in the bar. The restaurant, our menus have been carefully chosen to be ordinary and unexciting. I mean, some of this you understand what they were trying to say. It's not, the food's not too spicy, what they're saying. Your room. You will not be disturbed by traffic noise since the road between the hotel and the lake is used only by pederasts, which is not a word, in case you're wondering. I looked it up. Bed. Your bed has been made in accordance with local tradition. If you have any other ideas, please ring for the chambermaid. She'll be very pleased to squash your shirts, blouses, and underwear. If asked, she'll also squeeze your trousers. So don't ask. Above all, when you leave at the end of your holiday, you will have no hope. You will struggle to forget it. And I can read this and know exactly what they meant. But it's not a good translation. So this is kind of the kind of thing that happens when you're translating word for word. One of the things I wanted to talk about was because we are getting older and we are looking at the point where we can be finished in the Sakadao tribe. So I want to talk just a little bit about what it will take before we are finished. It's a huge question in missions, by the way. Huge questions, and it's getting huger. It's getting bigger. Some people plant churches by translating, and this... Okay, I went to a... Probably shouldn't mention names. I went to a missions kind of a training seminar thing. I've been to it before. It's out of Pasadena. And they bring different speakers in every night and talk about different things. And it's talking about basically how to do missions. And I was very surprised. I don't know how many nights we went, but the majority of the nights, the people that came, the ideas that they were giving, either didn't work or were plain heretical. And I thought, wow, if this is where we're going as churches, we're in trouble. But some people plant churches. This is real. They say you don't have to learn the language or the culture of the people. You go in, here's these 10 questions that you can ask about any passage in Scripture. You translate that into language, and you just give it to them. And they sit around in a circle, and they'll read a passage, and then they'll ask these questions. You know, what does this tell you about God? How does this make you feel? And there's these 10 questions. So that's a missionary. He'll do that. And once these people have agreed that they're going to meet together and read the Bible, and they're going to ask these 10 questions, they're a church. So we move on. So you can see that if that's the way you plant churches, you're gonna be able to plant a lot of churches in a very short period of time. You aren't going to have to go to the mission field and learn the language and the culture of the people. And you know, you could give them the questions and be gone in a week. I ran into a guy in Indonesia that was incredulous that it took as long as it did for us to plant churches. He said, "Oh, I planted 4 churches last month." And what he did was he went in, he preached the gospel in Indonesian to people who that was not their heart language. He asked for a show of hands, told them all the things that his church denomination was promising them if they would be part of their church denomination. He signed them up. In some cases, he may have even baptized them, and that was a church, and then he moved on. So chances are, and this is from experience talking to people, chances are no one understood what he said when he preached the gospel. The show of hands was a show of hands. That's what it was. How many of you have hands? And they had hands. Good for them. They were signing up because they promised them that they would build them a church, they would send their kids to school, they would do all these things. By the way, they don't do most of those things. They just promised them. So that's planting churches. Another, and some of these things I may actually be stepping on toes, so be careful here. But one of the groups was advocating out of a passage in Luke, I think, where Jesus is sending out the, I think he's sending out the 70 at that point. He was saying, if you, when you go into a place, you know, say, peace be unto you, and if he be a man of peace, that your peace will remain. If not, it won't. It'll come back to you. Well, you have to understand that was just a common greeting in those days. Basically, what he's saying is, if you go in there, if he doesn't receive you, then leave. You know, but if he receives you, great, stay there at the house. But these people have decided that the key to reaching any group of people now is finding that man of peace. That's actually an actual man, the man of peace. And he may not even be a believer, but he's the key. So if you once find that man of peace, that's the key to unlocking that culture. And I just thought, wow, not only is that a really bad interpretation of those verses, it's very misleading to people are going to be going in, and rather than spending time doing what they're supposed to do, they're going to be trying to find this man of peace because he's the key to unlocking that culture. And some of you may have heard that and you're really angry at me now. No, no, really, it's true. Well, no, it isn't. Okay. So what do we want to see in order to be finished in Cicada? We want to, and these things are at the bottom of this, but we want to have believers with a clear understanding of the gospel. That's huge to me. There's a church down the hill from us that's actually planted by a major denominational missions group, and the pastor is unsaved, and the people in the church, by and large, are unsaved. Pretty hard to have saved people in a church when the pastor's not saved. They don't understand the gospel. They just don't. And our people have gone to church there off and on through the years. If they go down there, sometimes they go to church there, and they tell us that, oh, nobody down there really understands the gospel. So we want to make sure they understand the gospel and that they're capable of sharing the gospel with other people. We want to have a church that's ministering to the needs of itself, dealing with sin, encouraging each other, training each other, teaching each other. If we leave, we want to see this going on. So we're going to have to not only train people ourselves, we have to train them to be able to train people. And we have to be ministering together with them and doing all of these things together with them. We need to have a church that knows how to do outreach and one that has a burden for the lost. And the way, of course, you do that is that you take them with you and then slowly you get them to the place where they don't need you to even go with you anymore in order to do that. And there are a lot of villages around us. As I mentioned, the one down the hill is a little bit harder because they're all church people, but they're not saved. We want to have leadership appointed. We call them elders. They would function as pastors. That's what I think most people would call them. Some churches have elders, and they have kind of a minor role in the church. This church actually is an exception in that. We want to see leadership appointed. We want to see the New Testament translated, and also we've got Old Testament passages as well. It isn't a requirement that we do the entire Old Testament. We're planning to do, actually, Bella and I are hoping to do quite a bit more than is required in the Old Testament, but we will almost certainly not be doing the entire Old Testament. And they need to have a solid understanding of the basic principles of the Word of God. They need to be able to teach. And so they need to, because I'm making curriculum, I'm making lessons, but they need to be able to go beyond those lessons. They need to be able to go into a passage of Scripture, look at it and see what it means and teach it on their own. They need to be coming up with things on their own, not just what they get from lessons from me. All right. Just so you know where we're at in getting these things done, we're 55% of the way through the New Testament. It's not all checked yet. That's one of the first things we're going to do when we go back is have a check. We have deacon candidates right now, but they're functioning as deacons. We have and deacons take care of the physical ministries in the church, and we have elder candidates as well, although they have some significant needs in their lives. I would be real hesitant to want to ordain some of them at this point. They do help each other spiritually. They deal with sin. They try to be an encouragement. It does tend to fall along family lines because that's the way they do things. And that's been hard for me to. I've been talking a lot about the fact that they're a family and they need to treat each other like family as a church. and not just, you know, one man, his baby died. So somebody said, oh yeah, you know, you need to go down where they're going to bury him and just be there for the family. So we did. And I looked around and nobody was there, because the only people that came down were his family. And I thought the church should have been there. They should have been there for him. They do know, people do know how to do outreach there. And they have done outreach on their own. And they do continue to teach in some villages. And some of them do have, I wouldn't say that everyone in the church has a real burden for the lost. But there are people in the church. That's one of our prayers, actually. So I wanted to move on to, this is, by the way, just so you can see, this is where we live. This, when we used to have an airplane, that's where this was taken. It was, the airplane is on approach to land on this airstrip. That's our airstrip. That's the church building. The village is all over here, covered by trees, but it's over there. And our house is over there too, covered by trees. That's more looking down at the village. The circle is our house. That's quite a while ago, though. But that's where we live. Actually, we've replaced the roof. You guys actually paid for that. We've actually had to replace the roof since then. So that's where we live. That's what we call home. What do we do? People will say to me, describe a typical day. I've had that question. Describe a typical day. I can't describe a typical day because my days aren't typical. We do a lot of different things, so not every day is the same as the next day. So rather than doing that, I thought, well, let's talk about the things that we do. And it's going to sound like a really long list, but keep in mind, I'm not doing all of this every day. No one could do all of this every day. Physically, we exercise. Both Bella and I exercise 6 to 7 days a week. She does the 6, I do it 7. I have issues with hypertension, so I exercise. She has issues with osteoporosis. So we don't want to be eliminated for what we're doing because physically we're not in good enough shape to stay there anymore. It's not that, obviously, not that we're trying to look like, you know, under all this fat, I'm really ripped. But we do exercise. We have to order food, and when it comes, we have to put it away. Food preparation, and I do very little of this. We don't use a lot of packaged food. We have to grind our own meat. We make things from scratch. We eat every day. We have house girls that wash our dishes once a day, and they sweep and mop the floor. And my wife pretty much does everything else. And sometimes she sweeps and mops because it's dirty. You know, she doesn't want the girls coming when the house is dirty. Really. Bella does laundry, and we have a little washing machine, and then the girls hanging out in the line. We do some medical work, although that's not something we really want to have to invest a lot of time in. Inevitably, we end up doing that. We also take care of the physical plant being our house and things that used to be the airstrips, not so much anymore. It's not the same here. You kind of here, if you want water, you turn the faucet on. There I have to pump water up to water containers, and I have to do that not every day. I think every other day I pump water up. We have to filter drinking water, and I'm usually doing that every day or every other day. I have to mess with that. I have to fill and start generators when I want electricity. I have to fix the generators when they break. I have to buy fuel, and then when it comes, I have to make sure it's... Anyway, I have to fix anything that breaks in the house. The plumbing, the electrical, anything that breaks, I have to fix it. I have to make sure the lawn's mowed. I do not mow the lawn. I have a lawn mower, and I have somebody who I pay to mow the lawn. To write emails and letters, that actually takes a lot of my time, and I'm not as, especially on home assignment, I'm not up to date on that. But and we don't have to, I guess, but I've got talking to our children and grandchildren. When we walk in the mornings, we go early morning. It's very hot there, so we'll leave at 6 in the morning, and we hike up, and we get up on the top of this mountain, and we get a cell signal up there. And so we'll oftentimes talk to our kids and our grandkids when we're at the top of the mountain. Our personal lives, we have devotions. We try to do it at every day. Bella and I pray together every day. We spend time talking to each other every day. That's the one I was supposed to be on. Okay, and then I divided it between Bella and I because we do different things. I work, as I mentioned, I work on exegesis. I work with language helpers on translation. I make corrections in the translations. I write the back to English. I work through the notes and questions. These are all things I mentioned before. We have to set up the checks, make sure everything, and that's talking to people, arranging things, trying to figure out who's gonna cook during that time, because both of us are involved, and we can't pop something in the microwave. So, and we have checks that we do two to three weeks a year. I work on teaching lessons. They all have to be in Staccato. Not only that, but they all have to be in a form that the teachers there can use, so that I can hand them the lesson and they can teach from that lesson. So it's not cryptic, it's not in a shorthand, it's not in English, it's all in Staccato, and it's all very explained so that they can follow it. I prepare lessons, well, it's really the last one, I prepare lessons for the children. We do have a children's program that's very much like Awana. To say, it sounds arrogant to say it's better, but it is. But years ago, we were the first Indonesian Awana program, and Awana is located where my wife is from. So we went to visit them and showed them what we were doing, and they decided to change their curriculum based on what we showed them. So, we like our program, and my wife and daughter made the books for it, and it's probably not better than Awana's, but it's good. It's a lot like Awana at any rate. We hike to other villages. I have to make PowerPoints. This is something new I've done. I felt like it would be a help to the people if every lesson we had a PowerPoint. So the verses, we project on a screen. We have them read the verses out loud. It helps them read because they're only semi-literate, a lot of them. It also has everybody, they'll remember it better if they're actually seeing it and hearing it at the same time. And then we'll have pictures in between, again, for the same reason, to help them to remember what we're teaching them. So I have to make those PowerPoints, and it takes me on average about an hour a PowerPoint to do that. And I meet with the men, I go over the lessons that they're going to be teaching. We discuss church needs. I teach them any new material. I teach the new material. It's something that's not necessarily they're going to be teaching, but they asked me to, like, for instance, they said, we want you to teach Revelation. So I started teaching Revelation. They're not going to be teaching that yet. I mentioned this before, meet with the children. We run the club. I work with kids doing the book work. I'm the one that runs the games, and I teach a Bible lesson for the kids. We meet with the church on Saturday night. We meet with the church on Sunday morning. We prepare lessons for the outreach villages. Actually, this is Bella. I should be waiting. We walk there. We teach. We walk home. Bella, she makes up the comprehension questions for checking scripture. She makes changes. She discusses problem areas with me. Those actually get, I don't want to say heated. They're vigorous discussions at times when she's telling me I have to change something, and I don't necessarily agree. So some people think, after meeting us, they think because I project myself as a strong, you know, domineering, and then Bella's, poor Bella. But actually, that's really not the way we interact with each other. She has no problem expressing to me her opinions over and over again. I'm not saying that in a bad way. What I'm saying is she doesn't necessarily back down just because I don't agree with her. You know, she sticks to her guns at times. And this is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. She makes Sunday school lessons. She actually was more on the ball than I was. She left Sunday school lessons for the entire time that we were gone, and she left them with the ladies primarily teach that. She left those with the ladies with coloring pictures for the kids and the whole thing. She did that. She meets with the ladies on Mondays. She teaches them kind of a devotional, and then they pray for each other. They share prayer requests and pray for each other. Of course, she meets with the church on Saturday and Sunday. Generally, she's the one that runs the PowerPoints, although there are some other people who can do that. She takes her turn teaching Sunday school when we're in there. She works with the kids' clubs. She makes sure someone is... We kind of have a division of labor in our whole lives, really, but in the children's thing, she does some things, I do other things. She makes sure someone's leading the singing. She's the one that... She works with the kids and memorizing verses and doing their book work. She's the one that keeps track of all the points. And that's really kind of beyond most of them. She gives out the awards at the end. She walks to the outreach villages with me and home again, and she's done this for years, even when she really shouldn't have been walking with me. She does all the literacy material, and she does literacy work. Oh, yeah, there were more pictures. And you had to stare at the same picture. I'm just really sorry. She makes literacy materials, and she does literacy. She's done literacy with the adults. She's still doing literacy with the children. They have a school they go to, but it's not uncommon for a third or fourth grader still not to know how to read. So it's been improving because Bella has been working with them, and the teachers are very appreciative that, because they don't know how to teach the kids how to read, is what it comes down to. So they either get it or they don't, kind of on their own. So she does work with the kids and helps them to learn to read. And the whole reason we're doing that, of course, is because we want to see a strong, functioning church that can meet its own needs and reach out to the people around them. So those are the things that we do. And again, pretty obviously, we don't do all of that in, you know, every day. There are some of those things we do every day, and some of them we do on different at different times. It is pretty overwhelming at times. Yeah, we are at that point. So go ahead.
When do you sleep?
Oh, at night. No, I know. I that's my one thing I was worried about, that it's going to seem like, you know, that we are dedicated missionaries, that, you know, we don't sleep and all that. No, we sleep. We have a TV and a DVD player. You know, there are nights when we don't have anything going on. Sometimes we'll watch a movie or whatever. So, you know, we can do things that are relaxing. Yes.
How many people speak Staccato as their first language, and then how established had Staccato been as a language before you guys got there?
Okay, I've never seen a thing. It's really strange when you try to look up an ethnologue to see anything about your people. You'll find that the ethnologues are hopelessly wrong. So Staccato isn't even listed as a language in the last ethnologue I read. There's about 15,000, as far as I can tell. It goes all the way from the Kapuas River, which is the largest river in Indonesia. It runs all the way across Borneo. It's the Staccato River runs into that. So it starts pretty much there in a town called Staccato, actually, and it goes all the way up river. And not every village on that river speaks Staccato, but a lot of them do. We work in what's called upriver Staccato, Staccato Hulu. And that was very intentional. The group that we work with, when we went in there, we had done survey around there, and we decided that there were a lot of villages within about 2 hours walk that we could reach, and that's the area we're targeting. So we're not even targeting the Staccato Hilir, the downriver Staccato people, but we're, you know, we have literacy materials. We have a Bible, children's Bible book that's we've given to people downriver. So we're expecting that this will impact them as well. But the primary group that we're working with is the upriver group, and I don't know, 2,000 people maybe in that area, I'm guessing. I don't know.
Established as a language.
Yeah, it was a language. Yeah. Actually, languages are interesting to me, maybe not so much to you guys, but go back about 250 years ago, and there are three language groups now, Gray, Laur, and Staccato, but if you go back about 250 years ago, they were one language, but they were separated physically, and when languages separate, they change. And when there's no interaction between them, they can change pretty dramatically. To this point, they identify now that there are three different languages, but I look at them and say, well, I can understand a lot of what people are saying on Laur. But when we came to Staccato, having spoken Gray, we could understand a lot of what they were saying. We would answer back in Gray, and they understood nothing of what we were saying. So it's only probably been in the last 100 years, maybe, that would have been identified as
a language. Did they have a written language?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. We had a Chinese guy that came in, and I think he worked on the alphabet some.
Okay.
But all of the tribal people in our area, they're called Dayaks. I don't know where that name came from. Kind of like Indians, you know, except that we know where that came from. But they have an orthography, a way to write all the languages, because they're related. And it's wrong. So that's a little frustrating, because people, you know, they'll put things on, you know, on shirts, sayings and different things, and you look at them and you realize that orthography is wrong. I mean, to somebody untrained, that's what it sounds like it is. But what they're doing is they're writing too many letters, because they're not able to understand that that's just a letter. That's not three letters, even though it sounds like it in your ear. Let's see. Okay, for you would be kapn. And it's pretty simple. How would you spell kapn? Well, the Dayak people, they spell it K-A-P-M, kapn, but it's not. It's just K-A-M. Because when M is at the end of a word, they always give it a full syllable beat. So it's cop, they're giving it a syllable beat. So it's not cop. So they spell it K-A-P-M. That's one of the things. They have glottal is a letter. Glottal is a stop in your throat. Okay, well, I'll just use that same word, but I'm going to put an emphasis at the end of it. So it's if I'm saying you, I would say got mom. That should be nasal, but they won't write the nasal marker, and that isn't one with glottal. So give me one with glottal. Apa, at the end of that in English, you're probably not even going to hear that. But at the end of, it's not apa, it's apa. You hear how I'm stopping it there? That's a letter. And it appears in different places, but they won't write that as a letter. Or they'll write it as a K. Or this anyway. So, yeah, it's established as a language. And I told you, as you can see, I'm way more interested in that than you are. Okay.
I'm going to talk to you in the broken English.
Okay.
But I will ask you, what do you consider, the English is better language, or that is a better language?
You can't say that.
Yeah.
No, every language expresses some things extremely well. They're aghast in Cicado that we have one word for rice. They have a word for rice when it's still in its shell. They have a word for rice when it's been shelled. They have a word for rice when it's been cooked. They have a word for rice when it's sticky rice. They have a word for rice when it's not. They have different words for all those things. And they think, one word? How do you know what you're talking about? Say, well, the truth is, we don't talk about rice right now. So, no, every language is unique to itself, and I don't know that there's any that I would say are better than other languages. Some of them express things, certain aspects of things, better than other languages. But, I mean, you run into that with Greek. For whatever reason, love must have been important to Greeks because they had, like, three. I just read four. I don't know what the fourth one is. But three separate words that we all translate love. So apparently love was more important to them. They have brotherly love. They have... They have erotic love, and they have what we call it godly love, but it's really not godly love. But anyway, we just say love. So that must have been more important to them, that concept, because they ended up with three words to express it. I just read four. I don't know what the fourth one would be. But so no, English isn't better than Scotto. Scotto's not better than English. They're just different languages. Okay, I think the time's pretty much done. Appreciate your patience with me, and I'm sorry I didn't give you more time for questions. We do so much appreciate you guys praying for us and your support through the years. So thank you.